Welcome to episode 60 of the Cycling Europe podcast. My name is Andrew Sykes, and it's been six weeks since I arrived back in Britain. Exactly 6 weeks. Today is Sunday, the 16th of October, and I arrived back in the UK on, I think it was the 3rd, or was it the 4th? I forget anyway. It was a Sunday morning, exactly 6 weeks ago, that I finished my Grand Tour, my 8-week trip around Europe. And hopefully many of you, some of you, all of you, I don't know, have listened to the 8 episodes of the podcast that I recorded, edited and published while I was on that long tour. Now, if you missed any of them, you can go back and they're all indexed at cyclingeurope.org/le grand tour. Just a quick reminder, part one, that was episode 52, was all about cycling down the Dutch coast, the Eurovelo 12. Episode 53 was about the Belgian and the French coasts to Dieppe. And then the Avenue Verte from Dieppe to Paris. That was the Eurovelos 12 and 4. Episode 54 was the Vélo Cenis from Paris to Mont-Saint-Michel. Episode 55 was the Vélo Maritime, again, back on Eurovelo 4, from Mont-Saint-Michel to Morlaix in Brittany. Episode 56 was me cycling down the Vélo d'Isère from Morlaix down to Royan. That was the Eurovelo 1. Episode 57, part 6, was the Véloroute des Deux Mers, which took me from Bordeaux down to Sète, and that was along the Canal de la Garonne and Canal du Midi. Episode 58, part 7, was my favourite bit of the entire trip, which was cycling along the Via Rona, the Eurovelo 17. And that was from Sète all the way up to Andermatt in Switzerland. And then finally, episode 59 told the story of me cycling down the Rhine, along the Rhine cycle route, Eurovelo 15. And that was published exactly 6 weeks ago. So if you missed any of those, you can go back and listen to them. And hopefully you will find them interesting, useful, inspirational perhaps, if you're planning your own visit to the continent. But this is episode 60, and we're going to return to how it was before episode 52, which is basically me sitting down and having a chat with somebody about something that they've done, which is connected to cycle touring. Now, today's guest, well, I actually recorded this chat last weekend while I was cycling in France in the summer. One morning, got this fantastic email from Laura. Laura being Laura Moss of the Cycle Touring Festival. And she announced that there was going to be a pared down gathering of the Cycle Touring Festival in October of this year. And that took place last weekend. I gave a talk about what I'd been doing over the summer, as did Tristan. Now, Tristan, he embarked on a journey in the UK, a bit shorter than mine. It was just 5 days. And, well, rather than me tell you all about it, I think probably the best thing to do is crack on with the interview. Here he is, sitting in the grounds of Waddo Hall in Lancashire. And I started, as I always do, by asking him to introduce himself.
My name's Tris Newey, I'm 48 years old, and I live in a town called Hythe near Southampton in Hampshire, which is just on the edge of the New Forest.
Now, we're here at the Cycle Touring Festival, and I've just heard you speak about a really interesting trip. Not a long trip, but a cycle touring trip that was inspired by a particular book. But before we get to that, what's your background in cycling, in cycle touring? Are you a long-standing member of the cycle touring community?
It's a bit on and off, really. I've always been cycling as a kid, and did the usual thing that everybody does seems to do when they get their driving license and stop cycling for a few years. But back in the late 1990s, I decided that just to keep fit and to keep healthy, I would cycle to work, and found an enjoyment in cycling again. And for a few years, early 2000s, did some cycling, bought a touring bike, went to France, went around the south of England, and then stopped again when children came along, several years out for that, and I've just started again with the same bike in the last few years.
So what's that bike?
The bike I ride, it's a 23-year-old Dawes One Down, which is very similar to a Galaxy, which many people might know, but it's got 26-inch wheels instead of the usual 700cs. But other than that, it's almost identical to a Galaxy.
You said you went to the south of France. Where did you go?
Well, it was in Brittany actually first. So took the ferry from Plymouth across to St. Malo, I think it was, my wife and I. Our first sort of proper tour went around Brittany. But since then, back to France more recently to go and do the Dordogne, which is a really nice area. So, yeah.
Right, so you have been on this tour in the south of England, inspired by a book. A book by H.G. Wells, but not The War of the Worlds, which is probably the one that most people have heard of. Can you talk about the inspiration behind the cycle tour that you've done?
Yeah, so funnily enough, in reading War of the Worlds, it was more recently, once my children were getting more interested in some of the science fiction and things, I recommended the book, and as is often the case, you end up reading it to them. And as I did so, realised that there was an awful lot of cycling in it. The character in that book was learning how to ride a bike. Cyclists are mentioned several times, and it led me to look into why that should be the case, and discovered that H.G. Wells, the author, was a very keen cyclist in the cycling craze from the late 1890s. And in doing some further research, discovered he'd written a book around the same time as The War of the Worlds called The Wheels of Chance, a bicycling Idyll, which it basically allowed Wells to indulge in his love of cycle touring. He wrote a book that was effectively allowed him to talk about his learning to ride a bike, the social norms and mores of touring at the time and cycling at the time, and made a fairly short novel, but one that's packed full of commentary and pointers to the craze of cycling at the time.
So When was H.G. Wells, when was he born, and when did he die?
Good question. I can't remember the year he was born. I know he died in 1946, so he kind of spanned that whole period of late industrial revolution and modernisation where technology was really starting to show its potential. And he was a visionary, really, of what was to come. He firmly predicted things like flight aircraft and how they might be used, particularly in war. But also he had an interest in that sort of social change brought about by technology. War of the Worlds itself is, in fact, a commentary about that. But he was had a strange career. He was at various times an apprentice in a chemistry shop and a draper's. Struggled at school, but ultimately succeeded and came back to the school he went to as a teacher, and then sort of moved on into writing and launched himself as a career writer.
Because there are quite a few of his contemporaries who I associate with cycling. For example, Conan Doyle was interested in cycling. Einstein,
yeah,
was interested in cycling.
Jerome K. Jerome, yeah, as well.
Do you think it was part of that late Victorian psyche of that kind of middle class man who was a writer or an aspiring writer that must have been the internet, well, that's perhaps an exaggeration, but it was certainly on the list of things that were cool to be seen to be doing in the late Victorian age.
Yeah, and I don't think it can be understated, actually, just how much a significant point of change the bicycle was at the time in terms of giving people the freedom of travel, freedom of movement that was relatively cheap and easy, and in bringing people together across various social strata. So cycling in the late 1890s really took off in a big way, and it was originally very much the indulgence of the upper class, if you like. So bicycles, pretty expensive things back then, but there was a bit of once people bought them, used them for a while, they'd either moved onto a newer machine or fallen out of love with it perhaps, and those second-hand machines were made more available to people who had lesser means. And so, although once you're on a bicycle, the great thing of course at that time was that if you're riding a bicycle, you don't know whether you're a duke or a draper, for example. So it leveled those social norms. It brought people together who might not have otherwise mixed. And I think that's also allowed that freedom to travel and to explore, which was quite of interest to people like Wells and his contemporaries, who would see it as something as a significant social change or force for change at the time.
Yeah, well, it famously also increased the gene pool in terms of the health of the population, didn't it?
Well, absolutely. And I think actually the impact on the people's ability to travel, people's ability to meet up with other people and to travel to see and engage with others from outside of the area that they lived in was important. And actually, what is quite amazing as well, when you look into the way the bikes were made at the time, they were quite, some of them were quite cumbersome machines, very heavy. It's actually amazing the amount of miles that were done and distances that were travelled on what today people would consider to be something very cumbersome and difficult to use, compared to modern bikes, certainly.
Yeah. It's just a pity that they invented the car, really, isn't it?
It is. And no doubt we'll talk about this a bit, but of course, you know, 1890s, Wells himself points out in his writings that learning to ride a bike and taking up bicycling then was absolutely, it was easy to do because there were no cars on the road. The motor car had recently been invented, but there was really none in regular use. So the roads were the purview of the cyclist. You had pedestrians, horse and carts. They were the only machines on the road. The cyclist literally owned the road, if you like. At the time, it was the fastest thing on the road, short of a bolting horse perhaps, but yes, no cars. So a bit of a cyclist paradise, really.
Now, the book that you were inspired by is called The Wheels of Change?
Wheels of Chance, sorry.
And I'm guessing that most people listening to this are like me, and whenever they think of H.G. Wells, they think of The War of the Worlds, perhaps one or two other books, but they don't think of this book called The Wheels of Chance.
No.
Why?
It just got lost, I think, under his other works. He lived in Woking for a short period, I think between around 1894 to 1896, and he was absolutely going through a prolific writing period at the time. So he wrote The War of the Worlds, he wrote The Time Machine, he wrote The Invisible Man. All of those are really well known, made into films, you know, televised and really known. But at the same time, in that period, he wrote this book called The Wheels of Chance, and I think it was just Wells's way of indulging in his passion for cycling. And I suspect he wrote it fairly quickly, and sort of in an intense writing session. But it's just never been really picked up. It's not in print, as far as I can tell, although it's available online now. And yeah, you just don't hear about it. It's a bit of a hidden gem.
And in terms of the chronology of when he wrote his other books, when did he write it?
He wrote it in 1896, which is actually about the same time that War of the Worlds was published. It's not clear exactly when things were ordered, everything was done in, but concurrently with those other works.
And was it not picked up by his publisher, or did they just kind of indulge him a little bit after the success of War of the Worlds? Or
it was certainly published, but it didn't get much of a print run. There are editions from 1913, but I haven't found anything really since then. I just don't think it had the popularity of his other works. The science fiction that he wrote was very much ahead of his time. It was really novel in terms of what was being produced. But The Wheels of Chance itself as a story is quite in line with a lot of other literature being done at the time in the style of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome, for example. It's a kind of mix of social commentary, humour, a bit of satire. It doesn't really fit in any one genre as such.
This reminds me, I spoke to Tim Moore earlier this year for the podcast, and he was talking about how he writes books about cycling, but he writes books about travelling other than on a bike. And his publishers are desperate to get him to write about cycling, because nowadays they sell far better than his books about when he's not on a bike. But it sounds to me as it was the opposite, perhaps, for H.G. Wells, and that, you know, hey, give us, come on. What was it? What did the H.G. stand for, by the way?
Herbert George.
So they probably, come on, Herbert, give us another science fiction epic. Don't give us this. We'll kind of publish your kind of bicycling kind of stuff. But you know, come on, give us more of what they want.
It's possibly true, actually. Not knowing much about the publishing industry of the time, it's certainly, I suspect that having written War of the Worlds at the same time, that certainly got attention and probably drowned out really the focus on his other works. And of course, that led to publishers picking up all his other science fiction. Although I think it's fair to say that Wells's interest moved on shortly after that. So in the early 1900s, he was writing other works of predictive science fiction and so on, and other social commentaries. And he never really went back into cycling. It was kind of done by then. I think, you know, he probably, there's some evidence to show he continued in his interests for a while, but by the sort of early 1910s and so on, his interests had moved on, and he'd was not really talking about cycling anymore.
Right, so the book, The Wheels of Chance, what is it about? Give us a short summary of the book itself.
Sure, so the book is a work of fiction, and it follows the adventures of a man called Hoop Driver, Mr. Hoop Driver. We never know his first name. And he's a draper's assistant, which is a bit of a drudgery of a job in Putney. And he's got 10 days holiday, and he decides that in his 10 days holiday, he is going to go on a cycling tour of the south of England. He's got an old secondhand machine that he's just learning to ride. And he sets off on an August morning, and on the way, he bumps into some other characters, a lady and other followers, and there's an adventure that follows, let's say, that leads him to have an interesting time cycling onto the south coast and then west into Hampshire.
So what genre of book is it? Is it a travelogue? Is it a romance? Is it a detective story? Is it a thriller? Is it a... I don't know. What is it?
It's a bit of everything. It's a travelogue in the way that Wells wrote in real places and real experience. He had, good knowledge of pretty much everything that he wrote into the book. So you can read it as a travelogue, but it's also very much a social commentary about cycling and the impacts it has on social change, particularly in terms of women and their ability to break free of some of the restraints that they had at the time socially. And it's also a romance and a comedy and a satire all at once. It's a bit of everything.
Do you think in any way it was autobiographical?
To some degree it is, because Wells himself was a draper's assistant and he absolutely hated that job. He's on record saying it was the worst time of his life, pretty much. He really detested working in the draper's shop. And he wrote that experience into the character of Mr. Hooper. He's finding his life very uninspiring and looking to have an adventure. And this is certainly something that was put into that. And at the same time, you know, Wells himself wrote in his experience of learning how to ride a bike and his experience of bicycle riding into the book through Hoop Driver as well.
There are plenty of people who read books. I mean, there are millions of people who've, for example, read The Grapes of Wrath, for example, but they don't go off on a quest across America. What was it that made you think, ooh, hang on a second, I could follow in the paths of this this man, this character, and recreate this this journey?
The circumstances were perfect for it, because I discovered the book, read it, realised that both the start and particularly the finish of the journey that's described in the book was not very far from where I lived at all. I had some time available to do a tour, and it looked like I could fit this journey in. I could follow in the footsteps, or sorry, the wheel tracks of Hoop Driver, go and visit the places described, and sort of experience the book through real life 126 years after it was written. And I could do that by taking one train from my from where I live up to London, and the finish would only be an hour's ride from my house. And I thought, why wouldn't I do that? why not?
So it starts in Putney and it finishes in...
It finishes in the New Forest at the Rufus Stone, but it starts in Putney, heads south towards the south coast via Guildford, Midhurst, ending up eventually at Bognor Regis. And then it heads west, going through Winchester, as far west as Blandford Forum, before heading back east again, and finishes up at the Rufus Stone in the New Forest.
Okay. And if you were to describe that route to anybody without having any knowledge of the book that H.G. Wells wrote, what would their reaction be in terms of a cycle route of merit? Is that a good route to take, Putney to the New Forest?
It's certainly an interesting start point. It's not somewhere I would have ever put on my list of places to start, being Putney. But actually, you know, heading to the south coast, that's not an unusual thing for people to do from London, absolutely. And the other areas is almost traditional cycling country. You've got the very bucolic Hampshire countryside, bits of Dorset and the New Forest itself. It's still today a place that's well worth exploring by bike. And so I think if you were to read it, you would recognise, as a cycle tourist or a cyclist, you would certainly recognise the attraction of doing that route today.
So you headed up to Putney. I understand you did it at the same week as Wimbledon. Yeah. Not a great idea, but so you were in southwest London in July, early July of this year?
It was early July. In fact, it was the day I actually went up to London was the day Boris Johnson resigned. So that was that was an interesting
the day the day I was standing outside the Westminster Hotel.
Yes.
In Le Touquet. Ah, right.
Yeah, that day.
What a great moment.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I took the train. It was I was getting off at Wimbledon because it was the nearest point to the start, and I hadn't realised it was Wimbledon at the time. So yeah, the train was a bit full, to say the least. Although on the plus side, there was another chap on the train with a bicycle, and we did get talking, and we were talking about our bucket list, and we both agreed that we both wanted to go the Great Divide in America, and that was it was a good discussion to have. So there's always a plus.
So you arrive in Putney. Now, what's your plan here? Are you camping? Are you taking hotels? Are you staying with friends? How is this going to pan out? How many days are you envisaging? How many kilometres are you going to plan to do per day?
Yeah, so it's 260 miles in total to the Rufus Stone, plus another 13 home. I had 5 days to do it in, so I thought that was pretty comfortable. It involved a couple of days of 60 miles, and some slightly shorter days as well. Three nights of camping and one night in a bunkhouse in Guildford as well, and I reckon that was doable. What I didn't do was properly check the hike profile, and that was a bit of a challenge just from part of the ride, for me anyway.
Okay. So just talk about five stages that you did?
Yeah, so starting in Putney, so the first day was from Putney to Guildford, only 30 miles, so it was a late start that day. Putney to Guildford, the next day Guildford down to Bognor Regis, but then back up to Chichester for the overnight, and then it was Chichester to Stockbridge, and then Stockbridge to Blandford Forum, and Blandford Forum home.
And that mirrored exactly what the story of the Wheels of Chance was?
Yeah, pretty close. So the first day, certainly, an overnighting in Guildford, but after that I was starting to overtake the narrative of the book. So, for example, Hoop Driver takes 2 days to get from Guildford to Bognor Regis. But then on the other side, when he gets to Bognor Regis, he elopes in the night with a lady.
Did you do that?
I didn't do that. No. My adventures were not quite as exciting in those regards. So I probably should explain.
Did you consider it?
I did actually.
Have you told your wife?
I considered maybe riding in the night. I think I was there, but no, I wasn't doing that. No. So, early on in the story, Hoop Driver comes across or meets what's described as the young lady in grey, who's a key character in the book, who's a young lady also riding a bicycle, and it does precipitate a whole string of adventures. And as I was riding through Surbiton, where this happens, thinking, I wonder which side road she would have come out on in this story, trying to work out, you know, if I could identify the same place. I did have a close encounter with a Honda driven by a lady, a grey Honda driven by a lady, but that was as close as it came to that kind of adventure.
So, continue with your narrative of the days, where I kind of interrupted you there.
Yeah, no, sure. So,
you're eloping at 2 o'clock in the morning from Bognor Regis.
So Hoop Driver, yeah, he elopes with a lady at 2 o'clock in the morning. I should probably go back a step, because there's an awful lot happens in the story between, particularly between Guildford and the Bognor Regis on the south coast, where various other characters come into the book. There's a man who is similarly dressed to Hoop Driver in tweeds, also cycling a bicycle, who's turns out to be pursuing the lady himself, and he's a bit of a cad. He's a married man, but he wants this young lady to marry him instead, or marry him. And Hoop Driver kind of gets embroiled in this relationship between the two. He sees himself as a bit of a at one stage an investigator trying to work out what's going on, and then latterly, when he kind of works out the ins and outs of this man's intentions, he becomes a bit more of a knight errant, a guardian, if you like, and feels very protective. So once they get to Bognor Regis, Hoop Driver offers to help the lady escape her situation, and they elope in the night, as you mentioned, and he actually gets away on this cad's bicycle. He upgrades, if you like, quite considerably from his old clunker to a very nice new machine, and off they go westwards. And what follows is a tale of tall stories on the part of Hoop Driver, who doesn't want to admit that he's a draper. He wants to make himself out to be somebody of high social standing to impress the girl, or perhaps just suggest that he is of her similar social class. And at the same time, the girl whose name you now know is Jessie, her stepmother and a party of other people are in pursuit. And they're over the course of the following miles, they get closer and until the end.
It struck me when you were talking about this earlier that this is a story that perhaps he kind of had big ideas about, but it kind of peters out towards the end, and there's... The problem is he didn't have a good ending.
I think that's exactly right, and I think that's probably shown in the first, all the descriptors and all of the social commentary on cycling is packed into the first third of the book. And
he didn't even give it a happy ending.
He didn't really give it a happy ending. No, it was definitely not. So, I was thinking all the way through as I read it that well, how is he going to pull this off? How is he going to get the girl, which is what you'd expect, really, but it doesn't. So the journey ends at the Roof of Stone in the New Forest, where everyone catches up with Hoop Driver and Jessie, and he's told in no uncertain terms that he's not suitable. He's just not the right class. He's not the right thing for her, and it will happen no more. And they part ways, and he heads off home. Without the girl, but with a nice bicycle.
You see, that would never get you a Netflix series now.
It would be a bit of a letdown, wouldn't it? And yeah. And I think for if I was to give the book a rating out of 5 stars, it would be 2 or 3. It's not his best work. The interesting bit really is around the cycling and the social commentary. Yeah.
Now, there's something we haven't mentioned, and that's that in the version that you were using to follow, there are also illustrations in there.
And one thing that you were doing was going around and trying to find those places that were depicted in those illustrations.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the key things that made doing the journey really, really interesting. So the 1913 edition of the book that you can find online, which I found, has illustrations in it by a chap called J. Ayton Symington, I believe it is. I might be getting that wrong. And when I looked at the drawings, I thought, these are pretty realistic. You know, normally you might expect an illustrator to take a scene in a book and form something of it that was that met that descriptor from their imagination. But there was some element of reality to it, and it didn't take a lot of research, although I didn't want to overdo it because that would have taken out the point of the trip. But a little bit of research on Google showed that they were drawings of real places. So what I wanted to do as part of the journey was to locate these drawings, where these drawings were made, and see what changed, and take a photo of my bike and of the place, and put the two side by side and see what they're like.
I'm reminded of Rob Ainsley's talk earlier when he was talking about doing something somewhere in the Lake District, and he, as a slight aside, he mentioned his photographer. He said, "Oh, that's my photographer," because obviously Rob writes for cycling magazines. So perhaps H.G. Wells had his artist. Perhaps they actually did do this trip back in the day when it was published. Perhaps they actually set off together, and he kind of wrote his narrative or sketched out his narrative, and at the same time there was his artist sketching out the pictures.
It's possible. I think the illustrator is a professional book illustrator. I think he was probably commissioned by the publisher to do it. I suspect it was a few years after the book was written, so not quite in the 1890s. It may have been in the early 1900s, although I guess not much would have changed. But it's certainly clear that he followed the route. He did what I did. He followed the route and the story, and for the most part, I think, maybe not everywhere, that element of realism is really sort of what added that interest to me.
Yeah, perhaps sales were flagging and they needed the local people to buy their books back. I remember seeing a very old film archive of a very large group of people back in the early days of cinematography outside the local cinema in the town where I live. And I asked the chap at Yorkshire Film Archive, you know, why? What was the point in that? There was nothing happening at the time. And he said, yes, but all those people in that picture, in that film, then went to the cinema to watch themselves on the film. So perhaps it was something similar. Perhaps all these people who lived in the places that he visited, thinking, oh, hang on a second, that's a book about where I live. I should go out and buy it.
Well, it's interesting, though, because a significant part of the book's based in Midhurst, in Sussex, and that is a town where Wells himself lived and had some formative years. He went to school at Midhurst. He was later a teacher at that school. He worked in a chemist's shop there and lodged in various places in the town. So he wrote that town into the Wheels of Chance as a place where some significant events happen, and he's also mentioned it in some other works, I believe, as well. Certainly formative years. But I found I went to the tourist information office at Midhurst, and they had a pamphlet on H.G. Wells, a famous Midhurst resident, and nowhere in the pamphlet does it mention Wheels of Chance at all. Mentions lots of other works, but the one that firmly sets Midhurst in the story doesn't even get a mention, which kind of reflects, really, I think, the fact that it may have been missed out in terms of or left behind under his other works in terms of popularity. But you do remind me that there was a film made of the book in the 20s. Apparently, I've not managed to see it. It was called The Wheels of Chance, so I'm still on the lookout for that.
Does it still exist?
I think it exists in some copy. I've seen reference on the internet to a screening of it at a specialist film club some years back. So there must be copies, but there's not one on YouTube that I can find elsewhere.
Well, you want to try the BFI, the British Film Institute, because you would think that perhaps the film and the book were not of pedigree, but certainly the person behind them would be worthy of interest. So presumably,
I might follow that one up.
There is a copy somewhere.
It would be intriguing to see how they filmed it.
Yeah, and how successful were you? Because you took pictures trying to recreate the images that were appeared in that version of the book. How successful were you in finding those places and then taking the images?
It was actually worked out better than I expected. I was prepared to maybe find one or two places or discover that they'd changed out of all recognition, but there were some challenges. So some of the locations were changed in the book, so he had put them in different places, but they did exist. And of course, one of the biggest challenges was the change to the road network. So in 1896, Wells put the characters cycling down the road to Portsmouth, which is now the A3, and of course, at the time, it was a gravel road. Very easy to cycle along in that regard, but now it's basically a motorway for all intents and purposes. So whilst I could still cycle alongside it on a cycle path, and I use that word advisedly because it was quite challenging, very overgrown and strewn with glass and bits of plastic and things, but you could still do much of the route, which itself was quite a surprise to find. But when I got to the locations that had been used in the illustrations, yeah, actually, there were, to some extent, fairly unchanged, albeit with different road layouts and added roundabouts here and there and things like that. But I was fairly successful. There's maybe one or two places where it was clearly in the imagination of the illustrator, and certainly towards the end of the ride. But for that first stretch from Putney down to Midhurst, very faithful.
And what was the place which was the easiest to recreate in terms of it really not having changed since he did his fictitious ride and you did your real ride?
Guildford High Street is almost identical to the illustration in the book, almost down to the cobbles in the street, although I think they've probably been replaced. And there's a bridge just outside of Cobham, just before the roundabout where the A3 joins, which I almost rode over without realising it was the same place, actually. But the bridge parapet, the house in the background, all still the same. Those are the two sort of memorable ones. And in Midhurst itself, the old water mill is still there, but it's because it's hidden behind a tree. You can't really see it as well anymore.
And were there any places which were just disappointingly, depressingly, completely wiped out by modernity?
I would say the stretch between Chichester to Portsmouth. In the book, you know, the characters decide on the spur of the moment to go up Portsdown Hill for the view. You can still do that, but it's a bit of a challenge because of the motorway that runs along that area. It's not a stretch of great beauty, I would say. But that's only kind of a small part. I would think that even coming out of Putney, I was, apart from some stretches alongside the A3, it was actually quite enjoyable. And you come across places like Kingston-upon-Thames, very nice, very pleasant, not that much changed, I suspect, from the time of before. And once you get into the lanes and the little back straight lanes throughout Sussex and through Hampshire and Dorset, you could be pretty much back in that time. If the road was only covered in a bit of dust and gravel, it would be identical, I think.
Did you find yourself following any modern day cycling routes?
Yeah, there was a few that coincided. Not really from London down to the south coast. It kind of didn't follow any sort of Sustrans routes or Mart cycle routes as such. But on the south coast, it followed NCN2. And from time to time, it joined other cycle routes and trailways and so on. So it was quite easy to create the route on segregated cycle paths and paths that were suitable for cycling, if you like. And I think in many parts you could really follow closely the route that was described in the book. You didn't have to take much in terms of a detour. It was surprisingly easy, actually.
So you've done that particular book, H.G. Wells, mm-hmm. The Wheels of Chance. Do you think it's a good model to follow to find these long lost forgotten books? I'm sure there are others out there, and try and recreate the routes. Do you have any in mind that you could perhaps follow in future?
Yeah, it's I like the blend of that historical record and adventure as well. So there are a few. I mean, there's another H.G. Wells book that I intend to do, The War of the Worlds. That's very well described in terms of places and so on. So that'll be on my list of to do at some point. But it's not, there aren't that many others. I have been looking. There's the sequel to Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome, Three Men on a Bummel, which is about a cycling holiday in Germany. I don't really know the details of it yet, but that's one I'm going to look into. But yeah, actually, I think maybe now there is a market for that kind of thing, perhaps, that kind of travelogue fiction where if you had a story that you could read and enjoy and then go and actually follow and see the places, you know, I'm sure I can't be the only one who's interested in that. And if there are any out there, I'd be really interested to know. I do know of a few modern works that do that, but the subject matter probably doesn't lend itself very much to that kind of following. And I'm now kind of really conscious of it, and I'm looking for it in books that I read. Does this lend itself to a visit somewhere?
It is nice to have again, to mention Rob Ainslie, he was talking earlier about all the obscure routes that he's done and the motivations, whether they be point to point, whether they be following rivers, whether they be following places that rhyme, Yarmouth to Barmouth, places like that, some quite comical. It is nice to have a ulterior motive behind your whimsical cycle tour.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, and I love those kind of things. And it probably, in many respects, it probably did inspire me to look into this one, because I was aware of some of those cycles that he's done through previous cycle touring festival, the online versions and so on. So there is that. And I have done a few day rides to places that have got historical and literary links. You know, for example, I've ridden to visit the church lynch gate that's made out of the timbers of HMS Thunderer that took part in the, I'm going to get this wrong probably, but I think it was the Battle of Trafalgar. And that's also a boat that's mentioned in one of my favourite book series by Patrick O'Brien, the Master and Commander series. So it was great to go and sit in that lynch gate and touch the timbers and say this was part of a warship that not only had a significant historical importance, it was also in this story, mentioned in this story, that this character is possibly, you know, touch the same timber or what have you. And in fact, as part of the ride I did for the Wheels of Chance, I did do a little side trip to the Chesapeake Mill in Wickham in Hampshire, which is made from the timbers of the USS Chesapeake, which was captured by the British in the War of 1812. So again, historically interesting, and also part of the canon of Aubrey Maturin stories that Patrick O'Brien wrote. So
yeah, and cycling is a great way to do these kind of things, because you know, if you're in a car, then clearly you whiz past these places. You never have time to reflect upon the significance. You never have time to just reflect in that internal monologue that's taking place in your brain. But whereas on a bike, you just kind of have lots of time to think about what you're doing, where you're going, and the significance of what you happen to have achieved.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the pace of travel's perfect, isn't it, for that reflective thought and to take in your surroundings and to consider it in the context of what you're, well, if you've got a purpose of going through that area, what that purpose is. You know, I've the attraction to me of these kind of cycle tours is always that you go at a pace where you're going slow enough to see things of interest and stop if you need to. And really get a feel for the countryside you're going through, but at the same time you're going fast enough to go from quite distinct areas in one day. You can move out of forested woodland of one type into heathland to urban areas and back again, and they've all got a different character and they've all got a different feel. And I love that kind of pace of change. It's what draws me to riding. You know, I'm not a fast rider. I think my average speed is somewhere just shy of 10 miles an hour, which I think is about perfect for travel, as you say, just to really get to understand a place and enjoy it.
Are there any particular quotes from the book that you think Yeah. H.G. Wells has really nailed it in that particular line.
Oh, the book is full of quotable lines. You press me for some ones I can pull out of my head. There's a great sentiment given in the book around the enjoyment and freedom of cycle touring. The character sort of shouts out as he starts off, a whoop for freedom and adventure, which is brilliant. But actually, what's really worth seeking out in it and maybe having in your back pocket for good quotable lines is around the cycling, the reality of cycling, his commentary on the nose, the human nose being an unnecessary exuberance that causes all sort of dismay because it starts to run and then you have to take your hand off the handlebar to get a handkerchief and it immediately starts to precipitate an uncontrolled dismount from the bike, for example. I off the top of my head, I'd probably struggle to get them, but I've got my Kindle note is full of quotes, and I think the one that sticks out and which made me laugh out loud is Wells describes a scene in which the cad of the story realizes he's been bested by Hoopdriver and they've eloped off into the night in Bognor Regis, and he walks across the floor of a dining room underneath of which all the staff can hear him moving, and they sort of, Wells writes in the book that there's a interlude of conversational eyebrows, and that just set me, I thought that was hilarious.
Thank you to Tristan for taking the time last weekend to sit down and record that conversation. If you go online, you can probably find a copy of the H.G. Wells book, Wheels of Chance, to download, and there are copies available on Amazon, although I think it's now out of print. If you'd like to find out more about Tristram's trip, you can visit his website, which is tristramjames.com. Tristram has written a few books, including a few about the shipping forecast, and I think Tristram James is his pen name. Tristram Newey is his real name. But anyway, his website, tristramjames.com. He's also on Twitter, and you'll find him on Twitter at Tristram_James, if you want to get in contact with him. Now, next episode, episode number 61, I'm going to be interviewing somebody who goes cycle touring on a small wheeled bike. Not sure if it's a Brompton or not, but I'm recording that next weekend. If you'd like to be featured yourself on the podcast, then get in touch. You can do so via the website, cyclingeurope.org/contact, or via social media at Cycling Europe, or via email if you email podcast@cyclingeurope.org. If you'd like to support the podcast financially, then please visit cyclingeurope.org/support, and any contribution you can make is very much appreciated. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Rob Ainsley for the music. Hopefully that will continue into the future. And I shall see you for episode 61 of the Cycling Europe podcast, coming soon to a podcast provider near you. Happy cycling.